I see it next in previews. Thank you so much, Lucio.
Before those generous remarks, I was telling my wife that that man who's going to introduce me, some 20 and 30 years ago, I knew as perhaps the best clinical scientist in Europe and one of the best clinical scientists in the world. You can't say one, two, three, but that was his reputation and remains my one-sentence summary of Lucio. So I was privileged to be introduced by you, and it's an honor and a privilege to be able to give a lecture in this place and in this, actually in this city. And I want to thank, now we should be on a first name basis, I guess, Linda, and say happy birthday and thank you for the invitation. And I should say thank you to all the leaders of the University of Florence and local authority and the director of the hospital. I'm looking forward to seeing this, what I heard is a spectacular conference room in a hallway or an entrance in a hospital. That is so un-American. So it's, but really, I can imagine. So I look forward to seeing this. I want to make one announcement that perhaps with the exception of one or two people, I know less about the liver than anyone in the room. I know how to eat liver, but I don't know a lot about the science of the liver. But I will spend a moment on it toward the end of the talk. I hope I don't spoil your birthday by putting too many things in this talk, but I'll try to go quickly past some of the things that may be a little too technical. I will give a review, to the best of my understanding, of the various viruses that play a role in human cancer. Some of them are easy to prove. Some of them, like HCV, provide challenges, although everybody knows it plays a major role in the cause. But I'll end with asking you, how exactly? What's the mechanisms? And I'll return to the question also of the lymphoid tumors at the end with the same kind of question. Before I begin this talk on tumor viruses, I wanted to tell you about an announcement in a meeting that was made just a few days ago. Yeah, if you look at the slide, it sort of says... I thought you were changing that to... Yeah, that's it. Thanks, Luigi. Okay. Professor Buonaguro and I worked together. He came as a postdoctoral, a long time ago. Yeah, he didn't have that hair. He had different color hair. So, okay, are we okay?
Yes.
Okay, anyway, we formed an international organization or group called the Global Virus Network just a few days back. And we think it's going to be very important. Italy is playing a role. Many nations throughout the world are involved, I think around 30 different countries. And they were represented with the directors of each of the centers that are going to be involved. And the purpose, I wanted to tell you in advance, because we're talking about viruses, is because there's a tremendous drop in the number of young medically trained medical virologists. We don't know the reason. One reason may be that MDs go into research less today, at least in America, and consequently medical virologist numbers go down because a great percentage of medical virologists came from MDs, from physicians. Another reason may be genomics, the attraction of genomics. Genomics is obviously terribly important for virology, as well as all of human medicine. But the attraction of genomics has pulled a lot of people into that specific field, it's sometimes at the expense of some other fields. So one was for training purposes. Another was the realization by many of us that although there are epidemiologists, public health people, surveillance people, to find new epidemics emerging, it is inadequate, the number of trained medical virologists that have responsibility for a new problem. Usually there's no one responsible for the laboratory in-depth research. We get involved by chance, and we thought that should no longer be the case. And so experts in every, and we want to cover all classes of human viruses. So we do, within these 23 to 30 centers that are formed, that are linked together, that will be working closely together, and that will raise money together. Russia, China, parts of Africa, India, Europe, of course, the United States, Canada, Australia, all of those places. So the announcement was just made, I think, within the last 24 hours. Those pictures are pictures of individuals from different countries that are center directors that are meeting the people who founded it. I was a founder of this with Professor Kurth of Germany and Professor Hall in Ireland. So just to let you all know about it. But now let me go to the conference itself. Thank you. So let me start by telling you that what we know, what we're sure about, all viruses known to be involved that everyone can agree on in the origin of a human cancer form an infection that generally does not go away, a persistent infection. How they persist, what mechanisms they use varies very widely. But I raised the question at the bottom of the slide, what if some viruses cause cancer but they don't persist? We would never know it. It's almost, I think about it a lot, but it's hard to do something about it. We call this a hit and run. Virologists have discussed it for a long time, but extremely hard to study. You'd have to do prospective studies. Or maybe, in thinking about it, I was thinking maybe we should be looking at memory B cells. Because if a virus came in and did some damage that led to a change in DNA, that led to a certain type of malignancy, and you go study it once you have the cancer and it's not there, you don't think about any such virus. But maybe we have to think of ways to approach some human cancers where there might be a suspicion by looking at, well, it'd be expensive, it would take a lot of patience, a lot of clinical cooperation, but it might be worth doing. So I just raised the possibility. When we think viruses in cancer, we always think of a persisting virus. But we're not sure that viruses that don't persist couldn't do damage and then leave because the immune system was able to remove them. In other words, virus not required to maintain the malignancy, only to initiate and go away. Now, many of the viruses I'll be talking about are not needed to maintain the cancer, but nonetheless, they stay. That's why we knew they caused the disease. We find their footprint or evidence of them in a way that we can say they caused this disease. But they're still not needed to maintain the cancer state. So these are the human viruses we can agree upon that are involved in human cancer in one way or another. Retroviruses, HTLV-1 for sure. The easiest one to prove, to really get as conclusive as we can get in science, is the cause of a human cancer. I would say it's the most definitive evidence. On the other side, HIV, it's not really a tumor virus, but indirectly, it greatly promotes the incidence of certain human cancers. Herpes viruses, Epstein-Barr, herpes 8, also known as Kaposi sarcoma herpes virus, obviously the papillomaviruses, hepatitis B and C, and the Merkel cell polyomavirus, all of these I'll be speaking about individually. Because of my experience, because of my own specialization and knowledge, and because we know more about them, I will emphasize retroviruses of animal and man, because you'll see the number of mechanisms we can get to cause a cancer by one type of virus, one family of virus, retroviruses. So I'll go spend more time on them for that reason and because that's what I know best. So the mechanisms, I already said this, are by far best understood with retroviruses for viruses causing cancer, both in animals and human. All are direct. That is, they act on the infected cell and lead that cell to become a malignant cell. They provide clear-cut evidence of causation. Yet, The mechanisms are quite variable, as you will see. Naturally occurring retroviruses include the leukemia-causing viruses, also known as oncoretroviruses, and when I was young, known as RNA tumor viruses. They cause leukemia or lymphoma in chickens, avian leukosis virus, mice, the mouse leukemia virus, various strains, cats, feline leukemia virus, cattle, bovine leukemia virus, monkeys, simian T-cell leukemia virus, apes, gibbon ape leukemia virus, koala bear, the koala bear retrovirus, and humans, HTLV-1. And we can say, in an indirect way, the lentiretroviruses also can contribute to cancer, such as HIV that I mentioned. But the lentiretroviruses are more often causing immune abnormalities. For example, in cats, the feline immune deficiency virus, cattle, monkeys, and of course, humans with HIV. Retroviruses can also cause other hematological disorders, such as aplastic anemia, neurological diseases. HTLV-1 in humans causes a fatal progressive paralytic neurological illness. HIV can also cause neurological problems. HTLV-1 and feline leukemia virus also cause autoimmune disease, for example, polymyositis. Breast cancer, mouse mammary tumor virus of mice, and osteopetrosis, the avian leukemia virus of chickens, can do that as well. The genomic structure of retroviruses varies. Once upon a time, this is all we knew, until the discovery of HTLV-1. All animal retroviruses that were known in the 1960s, 1970s, were of this type. They have just three genes, GAG, POL, and ENV. PRO just is another enzyme. It's a protease, but I won't get into detail now, but it's often with the GAG gene. And you have flanking at each end these regulatory elements. They're called long terminal repeat sequences, and these are flanking the viral gene. So these are the simple retroviruses, and they make up the majority of retroviruses. Now, what are the mechanisms by which retroviruses cause cancer? The first one to be understood was the transduction of a cancer-causing gene. Transduction meaning it captures that gene and was able to then insert it into another cell, and that caused cancer in the cell that it entered. So the virus captures a cellular gene. Those genes were called proto-oncogenes. This event is very rare, and it usually requires a high rate of viral replication. In other words, if this happens, usually you can easily find out because the animal, or if it happened in a human, would have a large amount of retroviruses easy to see replicating like crazy. This occurred in the transmission of the gibbon ape leukemia virus from a gibbon ape to a New World monkey. They were both pets in the United States living in the same apartment. The gibbon ape leukemia virus captured the proto-oncogene of the cell of the woolly monkey. The gene is called a cis gene. In reality, it's platelet-derived growth factor. And that entered into the woolly monkey and caused a fibrosarcoma. This also occurs with the feline leukemia virus. The cellular proto-oncogene FES was captured and results in multifocal fibrosarcomas. It occurred in mouse leukemia virus when it captured the RAS oncogene. Sarcomas and lymphomas were the consequence. It occurred with avian leukemia virus infection of chickens when it captured the SARC gene, and sarcomas result. It is not yet documented in humans. These viruses, thankfully, are generally defective. When they capture an oncogene, they lose some of their replication machinery genes. Therefore, these are a one-time event with very, very rare exception. If they weren't a one-time event, you could see a species virtually being wiped out by cancer rather rapidly. So thankfully, to capture an oncogene and then insert it into another animal, the virus loses, some of its replicating genes to do that, and therefore the virus goes out of existence after one time happening. So, as I said, we've never seen that in a human yet. This slide is an illustration of the capture of an oncogene. Don't go through it in detail, but on the top of the slide, you see a leukemia virus infecting a cell. The cell has a cellular proto-oncogene shown in red. It is captured by the genes of the infecting leukemia virus, and the rare recombination results in the capture of that oncogene. And then you see that when that is inserted into a new cell in the bottom left of your slide, that cell will be acutely transformed, usually resulting in a sarcoma. But then that virus will go out of existence that captured the oncogene. Another mechanism, and a very common one, is called insertional mutagenesis. This is, in nature, the most common way a retrovirus causes cancer, leukemia or lymphoma usually. The DNA form of the virus, when it integrates, integrates near a cellular oncogene, a proto-oncogene. A typical example is the gene of the cell known as MYC. But a great variety of gene targets have been reported and likely happened once in a human that we know about. I refer to the case in France, in Paris, where a patient was treated by gene therapy and the vector used was from a retrovirus. And that person developed if I remember correctly, a T-cell leukemia, and the mechanism was strongly believed to be insertional mutagenesis. I'll come back to that later. This was very unexpected because, as I mentioned to you, it requires lots of replication to integrate into a region near an oncogene usually. This was one or two injections, but it did lead to that leukemia. So once this happens, it dysregulates the expression or causes a gain or loss of function mutation. It is the most common mechanism, as I already indicated, of a retrovirus causing leukemia. And examples are the feline leukemia virus, mouse leukemia virus, gibbon ape leukemia virus, and the chicken leukemia virus, avian. Integration is semi-random, so the high viral replication is needed to find that right spot to integrate. And these are the types of insertional mutagenesis. Now, this is a complex slide if you're not used to these kinds of experiments or data. And just note where it says, I don't have a pointer, so it's a small handicap in me trying to show you something, but that's okay. Look where it says protein from top to bottom, and you'll see the normal protein at the top. You see what it looks like. But when you have the viral sequences shown in the white, I don't know if I can make this clear without a pointer, but look, anyway, you get an abnormal protein, or you get a protein that's overmade or undermade or made with a piece of the virus made in a mutated way by the viral genes inserting near the cellular proto-oncogene. Okay? So that's the most common mechanism. Viral genes insert here. There's a gene nearby that it can mess up. That gene is either expressed too much or it's mutated as a consequence of the insertion of the viral genes. There are some exceptions to the rules with simple retroviruses. Not all cause leukemia by insertional mutagenesis. In the mouse, there's a leukemia known as friend mouse erythroleukemia. And sometimes the virus particles have an envelope protein. The envelope protein is the protein on the outer surface of a retrovirus. Sometimes it's truncated. You get a mutated form, which is smaller. And that mutated form, the smaller form, known as glycoprotein 55,000, because that's its size, as opposed to the larger normal size, mimics erythropoietin. So there's no insertional mutagenesis. This is growth factor-driven erythroleukemia. So then I come to the human, where we had the case of a human given the mouse leukemia virus vector for gene therapy, containing a gene to treat the individual who had a genetic defect. This individual got acute T-cell leukemia, and the insert was near the transcriptional regulator known as LMO2. No viral replication at all was needed, and that was a surprise. So that was an exception to the rule. So the friend mouse erythroid leukemia is an exception. It doesn't work at all by insertional mutagenesis, but by acting like a mimic of erythropoietin. And the human that got this leukemia from gene therapy was a surprise because no viral replication at all was needed. One insert, it inserted in the right place, leukemia occurred. I listed another surprise at the bottom of the slide. Why don't we get leukemia with HIV? HIV replicates a lot. I mean, HTLV-1, the leukemia virus, doesn't replicate a lot, which I'll come to in a second. But this HIV replicates a lot. You'd think it would, by randomness, insert near a proto-oncogene and do something. Why hasn't it? No leukemia ever with HIV. We suspect we know the reason, because when HIV infects a cell, it leads to the premature death of that cell. So the reason we believe, or I believe, we don't get leukemia from HIV is that the infected T cell is destined to die prematurely. If it starts proliferating, it's going to die with HIV genes in it. So we wouldn't get leukemia. A third mechanism of retroviral tumorigenesis is that a virus encodes a growth factor mimetic. Well, I mentioned that with friend leukemia virus, it's mutant resembling erythropoietin. But that was a viral gene product. It was the envelope of the virus. So we have the example of the friend murine leukemia virus with the envelope protein, mentioned already, in which an internal deletion results in a smaller envelope protein, and that mimics erythropoietin. After sufficient time and erythroid replication, due to genetic or epigenetic changes, leukemia becomes independent of the growth factor. This is a friend erythroleukemia showing a massive splenomegaly. It shows the truncation of the envelope protein from the 80,000 to 55,000 by the deletion shown in the slide. And if you look at part C of the slide, you see that it's a mimic of erythropoietin and binds to the erythropoietin receptor, driving erythroblast proliferation, which ultimately leads to secondary changes. I don't think anyone understands how those secondary changes occur, which finally leads to a leukemia in the absence of the need for the GP55 erythropoietin mimic. Still another mechanism. The virus can encode an extra gene, but not a cellular-derived oncogene. This now shifts our discussion to human viruses. The extra gene encodes a non-structural, non-virus structural protein that can directly stimulate growth, proliferation, and promote genetic instability. It does it all. It doesn't need a cofactor. It does it all. HTLV-1 was the prototype example of that, the human T-cell leukemia or lymphotropic retrovirus. The extra gene is not derived from the cell like an oncogene. Its origin is unknown. The bovine leukemia virus and the human T-cell leukemia virus do not appear to require any cofactor. They seem to be able to do it all and alone. So we now move to complex retroviruses, first discovered with HTLV-1, the human virus, and now found in other viruses like bovine leukemia virus and the monkey simian T-cell leukemia virus. The extra gene causes growth promotion and or increases genetic instability. At the bottom of the slide, you see a reference to HIV. Lentiretroviruses such as HIV also have complex genomes, but no growth-promoting genes. So they're the genomes of HIV-1 and HTLV-1. You'll see how much more complicated they are, how much more complex they are than the simple retroviruses. These are mainly at the 3' end of the genome, where you see a bunch of extra genes. The critical one with HTLV-1 is known as the TAX gene and TAX protein product of that gene, right near the envelope, but a product of complex splicing. So we're going to be talking about that TAX protein and how HTLV-1 causes leukemia in a moment. Before getting into the human retroviruses, I want to make a point that at the beginning of the 1970s, there was very strong bias in the field. Just like before polio came, just like before the great influenza came, when AIDS came, just before AIDS came, it was discussed rather widely among scientific intellectuals, let us say, that infectious diseases were over in the industrialized world. I don't mean tuberculosis or hospital infections. They refer to great new epidemic diseases. This was passé, a problem to be studied only in tropical disease institutes, a problem for those people, not for us. Today, you could never say something like that. It would not be politically correct. Then it was. When I look at this history, I see over and over again when I read and when the experience I had that humans appear to have a memory span of only 30 years. In polio, just before the epidemic started, people were, let's say 1940s, were able to remember the great influenza pandemic of 1919. But by 1950, they were confident that the money and the research should go toward degenerative diseases only. With AIDS, I can tell you I was there. The arguments not only were strong, departments of microbiology in famous American medical schools were closed. Okay, period. The Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, was threatened with closure, or at least reduction, and it was not because of President Reagan, who sometimes takes the blame for a lot of these things. It was scientists who were making the criticism, oh, we don't need that anymore. So around 1978, 1979, 1976, that period, we could say that that was the ruling philosophy. Retroviruses do not infect humans. You were indicating a little bit about this, Lucio, I think. There are many reasons for this. This was a common criticism. It's a waste of time to look for them. No viruses cause cancer in humans. That was the conclusion of Cold Spring Harbor Symposium on the Origin of Human Cancer, organized by no less than James Watson. There were three virologists present. We had no impact at all. And that was the conclusion. You can buy the book, 1975, Cold Spring Harbor, Origins of Human Cancer. But the prejudices were quite strong against even the possible existence of human retroviruses because there were decades of repeated failed attempts to find them. They were easy to find in animals because they replicated a lot. My defensive argument against that was, well, those are the animals you study because they're easy to study. You get a lot of virus. There was little evidence of primates until the late 1970s. And human serum, in the presence of complement, destroyed animal retroviruses. The trouble with the study from California was that they didn't test enough viruses, not even enough animal retroviruses. And it turns out humans and many animal retroviruses resist the complement human serum. But in the early 1980s, the biases were destroyed. Viruses are now known to be involved in around 15 to 20% of human cancer on a global scale, a number I believe will rise. Retroviruses found in man linked to leukemias, neurological diseases, and one of the great pandemics in human history, AIDS, appeared, caused by still another retrovirus. HTLV-1 and HTLV-2 were the first human retroviruses. They were discovered in 1980 and in 82, respectively. The only leukemia-causing virus known as HTLV-1, I believe it is by far the best evidence for a viral cause of any human cancer, even though it's not known as much because it's unusual in the dominant places of the world, such as Europe and in the United States. But there is a clear-cut epidemiologic linkage. There are numerous animals that get leukemia by similar retroviruses. The virus immortalizes and causes chromosomal instability in its target CD4 T cells in vitro, which are the same cell type of the leukemia that the virus causes. And there's virtual proof of its causative role in that the DNA form of the virus is clonally integrated in the leukemic cells and no cofactor is known to be involved or believed to be involved. What do I mean about clonal integration? I'll come to in just a second. It's a very powerful molecular biological evidence, and I'll show you what I mean, as I said, in just a moment. HTLV-1 causes a very specific leukemia, adult T-cell leukemia, ATL. The latent phase can be decades, but once the leukemia appears, death occurs rapidly, usually in 3 to 6 months, has been the constant story. 1 to 10% lifetime risk of leukemia in an infected person. It also causes tropical spastic paralysis, a multiple sclerosis-like disease. It also causes autoimmune disease. I have already mentioned that adult T-cell leukemia, leukemic cells have clonally integrated viral DNA, indicating that the original malignant cell was infected. The virus didn't come in later as a passenger. All the leukemic cells are derived from that one first transformed cell. HTLV is transmitted by blood, by sex, and by mother to infant, just like HIV. About 30 million people are infected, about 1 million in the United States. I have no idea about Italy. This is what I meant about clonal integration. On the right side of the slide, you can see that the integration pattern random. It indicates infection occurred only after a malignant transformation, if indeed this was a cancer. On the left of the slide...
Yeah, it's on your left, too.
Okay. On the left-hand side of the slide, the integration pattern is clonal. Note the red for the viral sequences is in the same chromosomal spot, in the same chromosome, in every cell. And that's what we mean by clonality of viral sequences. Again, a very, very powerful evidence for direct causation. This is a picture of the first human being from which a retrovirus was isolated. That doesn't mean, of course, he was the first one infected, but this was a young man from southern United States with no interesting history, social, sexual, or occupational. This is where we discovered HTLV-1, re-isolated the virus twice again from this man. The lesions you see on his skin are infiltrates with leukemic cells. The disease has very definitive characteristics, which I'll review in just a second. We then found the virus in several of his family members, and this was the beginning of the realization that this virus stays locally and within families. Mother to son, that's how males get infected. Women get infected from mama, but also from boyfriends, husbands, etc., sexually. And you can get infected by blood. That's the first picture of the first picture of a human retrovirus from the very earliest days. You see it budding from the cell membrane at the top. You see the leukemic T cell at the bottom that produced it. That's the second patient we isolated virus from, and illustrates another type of skin disease. It can have a Sézary T cell leukemia appearance with these reds blotching all over the man's body. By the way, he had both the neurologic disease and leukemia, and that's very rare. Adult T-cell leukemia was actually described before the virus was discovered by the clinician Takatsuki and his colleagues in one of the southern islands of Japan and Kyushu. Typically, skin lesions of variable kinds, hypercalcemia due to turning on the gene by the same protein I told you about earlier, the TAX protein, which is what really is causing the leukemia, that TAX protein also turns on genes that lead to an elevation of parathyroid hormone. So you get hypercalcemia, lytic lesions of the bones, some lymphadenopathy, and a diagnostic morphology of the leukemic cells that I'll show you, and an extremely aggressive fatal clinical course. It almost always involves the mature CD4 T cell. Unusually, it can involve the mature CD8 T cell. More pictures of some of the skin lesions. Another patient where the skin lesions are outgrowing the blood supply. There's a lytic lesion of the bone and the humerus. And that's the diagnostic blood smear. A medical student can diagnose this. You don't need to be a molecular biologist or virologist or even a clinician. Make a smear, look at the cells, and instead of seeing the solidity and roundness of the nucleus of a lymphocyte, you see this starry-like appearance of the nuclei. The prevalence of HTLV in different regions of the world is summarized on this slide with a few different prototype viruses in blue, red, or yellow. We think the virus originated with humans being infected from chimpanzees in Central Africa, but this is not recent, relatively recent, like HIV, but would be very, very long time ago, and I speak of hundreds of thousands of years. Different prototype is involved in the Aborigines, people in Australia and in some of the Indonesian islands, the Melanesia, for example. It's scattered throughout the rest of the world. You see in the United States and in South America as well, it's scattered throughout both continents. It doesn't mean it's never in California. It just means most of it is East Coast in South America and Central America and the Caribbean within the Americas. It follows black populations. About 2 to 3% of Americans, African-American background, carry HTLV-1. But it depends where in Africa their families originated from. That's how stable the virus infection is within a population. For example, in the Caribbean, you can find some islands like Trinidad and Jamaica, Martinique, I think, also, that have a high rate of infection, Haiti. But you can go to another island where there's no infection at all. And then work by Guy Dutay in Paris and his colleagues showed that it depends where they exactly came from in Africa. And then parenthetically, the neurological disease was discovered by a graduate student who did a postdoctoral with me. Unfortunately, he's from Paris. He didn't do the work with me. He did it with Guy Dutay. Before he joined me as a student, he discovered the neurologic disease caused by HTLV-1. It's an amazing story of a young MD who was aware. Antoine Jussain is his name. This is the concentration of HTLV-1 in the southern islands of Japan and even of the mainland, in the southern region. In the Caribbean, I've already mentioned that. South America, I already mentioned. And here are some parts of Australia and some of these islands, the Solomon Islands, Melanesia, Papua New Guinea, well, much of New Guinea. But why is it relatively important? For example, in London or especially Miami, I think the reasons for that are pretty obvious. In London, it's from immigrants from Jamaica and from some of the other Caribbean islands. And in Miami, they get the people coming from South America and from Central America that have a relatively high rate of infection. I already indicated it's a very ancient origin. Chimps have an identical virus to that which is in man. We believe that's what happened. Now let's go to the mechanism of how HTLV causes leukemia, and you'll see that it's different from any animal retrovirus. The survival of this virus depends on propagation of the cell that contains the integrated viral DNA, because this virus replicates very little. Extremely difficult to find this virus. I mean, this was really a nightmare, much more difficult than HIV. There's so little viral replication. So how do we transmit this virus? We believe it's transmitted with the whole cell. Sexually, a tear in blood, and mother to child, particularly by breastfeeding. So survival of the virus depends on growth of the T cell. We think of this, let's say philosophically, is that the adult T-cell leukemia is the occasional accidental consequence of this strategy of the virus to survive. If 5% of people per lifetime get leukemia, 4 to 10%, why did the rest not get leukemia if no other cofactor is needed? We're not positive no other cofactor is needed, but after all this time, 30 years, no cofactor has been defined and doesn't appear to be any. I believe because it's a random change of the chromosomal instability induced by the TAX protein. So the TAX protein makes cells become immortalized. They can live, But then in some of those cells, the right change in the chromosome occurs and you develop leukemia. In other words, if humans live to be 300-400 years old, I believe everyone would get leukemia from this virus. That's how I look at it. And regarding the neurologic disease, probably we have to think of autoimmunity, though the mechanisms are there far from known. So the molecular pathogenic mechanisms for HTLV-1 center on the TACS protein. It transforms T cells, inhibits apoptosis, promotes cell proliferation. It does other things that dysregulate cellular gene expression. It dysregulates cell cycle and promotes genome instability and loss of mitotic checkpoints. It also inhibits the expression of the DNA repair enzyme known as DNA polymerase beta. So it does a lot. Thus, HTLV-1 pathogenesis is critically dependent on the TACS protein in the initiation and in the early stages of pathogenesis. But unlike papillomaviruses, it is not needed in the maintenance of the transformed cell, which can have many distinct but not necessarily common molecular lesions, differing therefore from CML with the ABL gene or Burkitt lymphoma with the MYC specific translocation, and certain other cancers that are defined by a specific molecular lesion, but more like what may be more for common in most other cancers that have more than one pathway to neoplasia. This is my last slide in HTLV. I believe this is a true breakthrough. It comes from Parkish Gill at the University of Southern California and from the University of Lebanon by Ali Bazar Bashi, a young MD. With interferon alpha and AZT, which they used because of its antiviral activity, which to me made no sense, because by the time the leukemia occurs, we shouldn't need the virus anymore. That's all our data indicate. Nonetheless, they made a breakthrough at the beginning just with interferon alpha and AZT. But then Bazar Bachi from Lebanon added arsenical compounds. I guess my corrections on my slides didn't make it because it's not arsenate as such. It should be arsenical compounds. Oh, boy. Anyway, with that, a disease that had a 3 to 6 month survival time from the beginning of its appearance, they are now obtaining complete remissions. I heard one clinician refer to it as a cure. I can't swallow that very easily, so it needs a little more time and analysis from other groups. But I heard an uninvolved clinician say complete cure. So this is really dramatic, and certainly the singular most important work in this field since the discovery of the virus. And it's interesting to see a young unknown from Lebanon. I mean, I just also, why am I surprised? I shouldn't be surprised. Knowledge and truth come from anywhere, as the sign on our institute door says, but sometimes unexpected. So this is the last slide on HTLV. The legacy of this virus is obviously because it's the only known leukemia virus, and it doesn't seem to be needing any other cofactor. That would be the only one that I know of. Because it can immortalize cells, which is useful in the lab, and it was the sole source of the idea and the technology for the discovery of HIV. And lastly, it may provide molecular insights into the mechanisms of leukemogenesis or even other cancers, as well as some neurological and autoimmune disease. So it's a good thing, perhaps, to play with in the laboratory. What about HIV? Well, HIV, I like to think of it as a non-tumor virus that is tumorigenic. That is, HIV can increase the incidence of some cancers, and we believe not just from simple immune suppression. These are the cancers that are increased in the presence of HIV, and of these, and most of them are associated with viruses, right? Or all of them in this slide. We now see lung cancer a bit on the rise. We have no virus known with lung cancer, but it's, for me, a stimulation to look. When you see an increase in cancer from HIV, I repeat, it's generally when there is a virus involved in that cancer. So what is HIV? How do we look at HIV? Well, HIV is infecting the cells in red, but it's the cells in yellow that grow, that become hyperplastic, and ultimately become neoplastic. but they're not infected with HIV. So the effect is extremely indirect. Kaposi sarcoma and non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphomas are the two main but not the sole cancers markedly increased by HIV. The co-carcinogenic role of HIV is mediated by the microenvironment, and it mainly involves HIV proteins and cellular cytokines that HIV stimulates. In the models of tumorigenesis, we have spoken, number one, that the virus can act by insertional mutagenesis without transforming the cells directly but turning on a nearby proto-oncogene or dysregulating or mutating a cellular gene nearby. The virus can affect cell cycle or lifespan but does not directly cause the tumor in that it doesn't directly transform. EBV and the KS herpes virus, or HHV8. A virus can encode a gene that transforms the infected cell, HTLV, HPV. The virus acts very indirectly, affecting the microenvironment, not necessarily reside in the tumor cells at all. Hard to get exact mechanisms. We would call HIV an example of that. Would we call HCV an example of that? I think so. So if I had to put HCV somewhere, I'd put it with number four. Human papillomavirus, 16-18, select other strains high risk for those cancers, you know that. They may have cofactors augmenting them, but I don't know if they're I don't think there's evidence they're needed, so it would be more like HTLV1. The role of integration, they do integrate, but the role of integration is not yet clear. Perhaps they stabilize or enhance viral transcription. The E6E7 protein story seems to me to be definitive, contribute directly to the cancer by dysregulating cellular factors, and are thus oncogenes. Like HTLV1, some HPV strains, therefore, are clear, direct causes of cancer. Gamma herpes viruses like EBV and the HHV8 are the next group I want to go into a little more detail on. With EBV, we know that it's involved in Burkitt lymphoma, of course, and nasopharyngeal carcinoma, some Hodgkin's disease. Yet EBV is present in, what, about 6 billion people? So it's hardly a significant tumor virus. I mean, everybody has it. Rarely do you get the cancer associated with it. But the association with a driving B-cell proliferative factor, such as malaria, suggests chronic stimulation, immune stimulation, is a cofactor with EBV. The c-MYC rearrangement seems to be required for the bulk of these lymphomas, and HIV is a cofactor for some EBV lymphomas. Well, I had a question mark there. I don't think it's a question. Tungo oil and croton oils may be cofactors for the NPC, and they contain this TPA, which activates lytic viral replication. What is the evidence that EBV causes the cancer? The Burkitt lymphoma onset is predicted by a rise in antibody titers to lytic phase viral proteins. NPC patients have elevated antibody titers. That's hardly, it's evidence, but it's hardly conclusive. So the molecular biology or cellular biology data for EBV is not overwhelming. And, it's hard for me to say, yeah, that's for sure. I think EBV plays a role. It's epidemiologically properly linked. I think there's no question about that. But I think that role is needing always some other serious cofactors. However, there are some forms of Hodgkin's disease in which the Reed-Sternberg cell have clonally rearranged viral episomal DNA of EBV. And strangely enough, a tumor we don't associate so strongly with EBV may be the one that we have the best molecular data for, but that's only in some forms of Hodgkin's. The herpes 8, or KSHV, the apparent prevalence worldwide varies from 1 to 5% in the U.S. and U.K., Caribbean, and India, to 30% in some parts of Italy, to 60 to 70% in some regions of Africa. Its prevalence is in 100% of KS patients, and in primary effusion lymphomas and in Castleman's disease. That's clear enough to say, in my mind, that this is causing the disease. It's necessary. But again, an extremely rare event. So in the absence of the proper cofactor like HIV, well, you know, I used to say the dermatologists would be driving those Volkswagen buggies instead of Mercedes-Benz. HIV put HHV-8 on the map. HIV co-infection results in 10,000 to 100,000-fold risk factor, far more than the herpes 8. But you need the herpes 8, and you can have HIV and not have CAPA-C, but you can't have CAPA-C without herpes 8. It's really not an enigma. We can understand it, but it's interesting, isn't it, statistically? It's present in the majority of what we believe are the tumor cells of KS, the spindle cells. It's expressed that the genes are active, making RNA, in 90 to 95% of the spindle cells in late KS lesions, but only a few percent of the early lesions. Interesting. When you take KS spindle cells and you put them in culture, you don't find herpes 8. It used to drive me crazy when we were trying to verify this. So I get a biopsy. You know herpes 8 is there. Really linked to the tumor, you immediately culture it. Within a passage or two, it's completely gone. You give it to somebody to examine, no herpes 8. It's very interesting. So what is the role of herpes 8 in KS? It's necessary, number one. Its prevalence is so very much higher than the incidence, it must be very inefficient. We know that the big increase, we discussed it already with HIV, HIV is a greater risk factor than herpes 8, but is not necessary. The infected cells are rare in the early spindle cells, but in the late stage, they all have herpes 8. One major factor in the enormous enhancement of KS development with HIV is due to the HIV protein TAT, in our experiments at least. Experimental models in vitro and in vivo in our laboratory some years ago showed that the TAT protein of HIV increases inflammatory cytokines and the development of new blood vessel formation, angiogenesis, which are part of KS lesions. They also turn on specifically several genes of herpes 8, and particularly one that I'll talk about beginning with this slide. TAT accelerates KS tumorigenesis in a mouse model, a xenotransplant with cells expressing the gene which is called the viral G-protein-coupled receptor. In other words, in the herpes 8 genome, there is a homolog of a G-coupled protein receptor, a G-protein-coupled receptor, rather. So you have a homolog of such a receptor in the genome of herpes 8. When that gene is turned on, we have bad things happening that drive the cells towards neoplastic transformation. And the HIV TAT protein makes this gene much more active. Now, we developed this mouse model, and it produces KS-like lesions in a mouse. But if you can look at the top, you can see that in the presence of TAT, the tumors appear earlier and much more numerous. Unfortunately, I don't know why, I seemingly have my wrong talk. The slides at the bottom should be colored. In any case, the growth promotion is when you have also TAT present. But here's an interesting result. The bottom part of the slide especially. These neoplastic cells are called GR3. They're cells that have this G-protein coupled receptor gene turned on. They produce a KS-like lesion in a mouse. If we take a cell that is expressing TAT and we put it, look at below part B, you put it in one arm. The cells are expressing TAT in this arm. The cells expressing the KS gene VG protein coupled receptor in the other arm. In the absence of the TAT in this arm, the animal will get KS lesions. But if you have TAT expressed in the opposite arm, the tumor just explodes. That's the best way I can put it. Let me go back a second before I leave the topic. What is the greatest question in Kaposi sarcoma and herpes 8 research today? In my mind, it's one, and that's waiting for a young person to discover Africa has HIV with herpes 8, Kappa C. But Africa has, as has been known for a long time, beginning probably in Naples studies, at least bringing it to Western world. There are pockets in Africa, equatorial Africa, that have very high KS without HIV. What's the cofactor? I mean, there's got to be a cofactor there. I'd like to think it's another virus or some virus yet to be discovered, maybe. But this is a wide open question. Buono Girls in Naples should have found the answer to that 20 years ago, but this remains an open question. Merkel cell carcinoma virus is the newest, by our friend Patrick Moore, found it. And it's also kind of interesting in that here you have real evidence it's clonally integrated. This virus, polyoma virus, is clonally integrated. Yet the virus that you get out of that tumor, this is a very aggressive skin cancer, is not infectious. And the vast majority of people who have it never developed this tumor. It is believed that sunlight is involved. HIV can also be a cofactor. Now I come to my final couple of slides, where I will expose my great ignorance on it. And I'll apologize. This slide was also corrected to be in a simpler form. Somehow I got the wrong talk. So you know all the stuff that's on this slide. Let me get to... with HPV, we kind of have some mechanisms to think about, but even so, it's still not easy from tumor virology or molecular virology point of view to put it all together. The mechanisms still appear to be rather indirect, yet HPV is in the tumor. There are suggestions that, you know, for integration, not suggestions, there's evidence it can integrate. There's molecular evidence of certain things predisposing to to hepatocellular carcinoma with changes in the HPV genome, the so-called X protein having its pleiotropic effects on cell cycle and causing apoptosis, et cetera. But I can't put it together. I've read reviews on it. I don't know exactly how HPV results in cancer. Worse is HCV. Which I come to in a second. So at the end, I guess the most current ideas in the mechanism of cancer of the liver is from immune responses, the X protein, and some people have even argued for insertional mutagenesis. But if it's insertional mutagenesis, it's got a way to go to be proven. And the key question to me, do all neoplastic cells have the HPV sequences? I can't find that in the literature. Are they clonal? I can't find that in the literature. Okay, we come to HCV. What's its pathogenesis? This is even more of a nightmare. Clearly it's linked. Clearly it's important. What do you say is the mechanism? You need to get cirrhosis? Why? You can get cirrhosis just from alcohol. You can get cirrhosis from all kinds of things, I guess. Does immune collateral damage contribute to the carcinoma? If so, how and why? Liver damage or regeneration, you know if you keep cutting a liver and you regenerate, you don't get cancer. So you would have to argue that it's the inflammatory changes plus the proliferation. Does HCV make any direct contribution to this cancer? Do you know what I mean by direct now? I'm acknowledging that it's a causative agent, but I'm also saying it upsets tumor virologists. What the heck is the mechanism here? Is it indirect? Like HIV, and just setting up a nidus nearby? Could there be a hit-and-run effect? Virus comes, doesn't have to be around all over the liver. I don't know if this is true, but a colleague at NIH who comes from Italy, Patricia Farsi, told me 2 months ago that when she looks at the liver sections of a liver cancer with HCV, she finds the bulk of the virus not in the tumor, but at the tumor edge. What the heck does that mean? Is it true? Is that your experience of anybody? Has anybody done it like she's doing now? Why is she doing this so late? This field is not new. It's relatively new, but it's been around for a while. Is this the first time anybody's exploring systematically the tumor for HCV? sequences? I hope not. So to me, very little is clear on the key questions. Until I was coming to this meeting, had no idea that HCV is more or less an acceptable cause of some B-cell lymphomas. Do I believe that? I'll believe it maybe after this meeting. Right now, I don't know if I believe it. I mean, I'm listening to people who tell me, yes, it does, there's no question, but, you know, you better get towards mechanism. So my last point is that you have a very rich future. There's a lot of work to be done on the hepatitis viruses from what I see of the literature. Maybe we could agree with that. So I accept that it's causing it, but one would like to you got to get to mechanisms, and we got to get more data on the presence of virus in tumors and whether they're clonal or not clonal, and somebody publish a clear-cut paper on that. That would be a big help for me. That would make the field clearer and with the questions now being much more difficult. But we have the examples. We have HIV, and you have Heliobacter. So how more indirect could you get? In any case, thank you very much for putting up with this long talk.
Thank you very much, Dr.